what is what, about 10 minutes after, I said, the telephone number is 212-209-2900. And I spoke about Haiti. One person called, that we were able to talk at length. Matter of fact, beyond length. Right? Now, I have to leave now. The board is full.
It was Pat O'Reilly.
You see? And so on. You know, so it's like that. But thank you very much. You know, the discussion will continue, of course. That is, and I want people to understand, I'm not ignoring. I'm saying that part of it is that when we're citing situations, then let me say, where we have been sabotaged, we cite it as if that is the only outcome we'll ever have. That is the only, and I'm totally against that. Because I said before, we look to the future calmly, confidently, and courageously. And some see things as they are and say, why? I dream of things that never were and say, why not? And that is it. So don't forget those elements. Oh, you can call 212-209-2992. Give a name and a number clearly. It is not, you're not going to get me. It is strictly a voicemail situation. 212-209-2992. And if you leave your name and phone number, I'll get back to you. Not necessarily tonight. Or you can write to labrish@hotmail.com. And we will try to get things done with you there. And again, thank you all so very much for listening. You've been listening to Labrish. My name is Haptah Selassie. We'll be back next week with another edition of the program. Labrish is produced by Ian Forrest with assistance from Sadusa Kaim Billy and is a The Jazzmac production. Remember to tell the people whom you love that you love them and show affection. With love, we'll find unity and strength. One love. Walk good. Mr.
Got to build our
Tosh.
On one foundation. Got to build our love. On one foundation. Got to build our love. On one foundation.
There will never be, no love at all. There will never be no love at all. I've got to put aside name segregation. I've got to put aside name organization. I've got to put aside them denomination. There will never be no love at all. I mean, there will never be no love at all. So build our love on one foundation. Come, let us build our love on one solid foundation.
Got to build our love.
Oh, there will never be a single drop of blood. You won't have no freedom, Got to come together. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather.
Thank you.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Gregory A. Wilson, a musician, academic, and writer. Well, we'll get into those. Stay tuned. Natalie Merchant. The 1911 song, Come Take a Trip on My Airship, which I didn't know was some old little Irish ditty. I just thought it was like this cool old song. And I had looked up the sheet music and found it. And then one time when I played it on the air, Rick Bowes said, oh, yes, old Irish song. And I thought, yeah, Rick, everything's an old Irish song when it passes through the filter of Rick Bowes. But Rick, who knows everything, was absolutely right. And then I found a recording, a very, very scratchy public domain recording of the song by a little Irish band. And indeed, there it was.
And now, by extension, we end up with Natalie Merchant.
Yeah, well, I love her version.
Yeah, she's yeah,
and I have to say the old version. I will see if I can get it cleaned up or something. Mm-hmm. But it's a lot of work to do that.
Yeah,
because the more you equalize it, the deader the sound becomes.
It was a problem with the Robert Johnson recordings when they were trying to do those new ones. They had the same issue,
Yeah.
And it would be a crime to make Robert Johnson sound flat, So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you either put up with this flat, equalized, compressed sound, or you get the surface noise of the 78s and all the bad quality. But they have been using new techniques of late. I have noticed at least some recordings from the 20s. Mm-hmm. Coming out with superb, engineering.
Yeah.
To restore them, superb restorations, sometimes sounding better than they were originally recorded. Recently, I read in the New York Times and I heard a couple of songs. Sophie Tucker, they revived
Wow. The
Sophie Tucker recordings.
Oh, wow.
Of all things. And if anybody wants to hear what they're like, you go to Amazon.com and you can get like 30 seconds of each song. And the sound, I have heard Sophie Tucker stuff, it's unlistenable because of the quality, but they've done amazing.
Wow. A lot of it's just time, is just, hours spent, reducing waves and, sort of painstakingly individually, I understand, doing some of that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which is, an enormous time sink, but
It's about as, not quite as much as restoring movies,
mm-hmm.
which is hard enough.
Right, sure.
And I've noticed occasionally, even when they restore movies, it's easier to do silent movies because they can record a new soundtrack.
Yeah, yeah. But it's worth it to get that wonderful stuff back. So
yeah. But it's also very expensive.
Yeah, I'll bet it is.
So somebody's got to pay for it.
Yeah.
Somehow it's got
always
to
comes
be.
Back to that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. It's if it costs, I don't know, $5,000-$10,000 a song at the minimum,
yeah,
to restore that. That means that an album is going to cost, over $100,000 to restore.
Right, which a lot of first albums, which I can say from experience, a lot of, band albums that are just, modern bands releasing albums are not spending that kind of money, or not having studios spend that kind of money on them, with modern technology. So, yeah, cost efficiency would be an issue there, definitely.
Yeah, it is. And it just occurred to me, you've never brought me any of your music.
No, I thought about bringing that this morning, and I was so, anxious to make sure that I brought the stuff to read and so forth after we spoke yesterday. I totally forgot. Although it is available on my website and on our band site.
Your website, when last I looked, which was actually earlier today,
yeah.
I was getting an error.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. My webmaster has been notified, but I didn't know this until this morning, again, when I checked before I came here, and I don't think he was up pre-Hour of the Wolf, so he will have it, I'm sure, fixed by tomorrow if it is not up already.
I'm going to just take a quick look, but for people who want to know, it's GregoryAWilson.com. It was Gregory the Wilson. No, it's still down.
Yeah, it's still down. Yeah, okay. Internal, yeah, I emailed him.
I knew it was local because it's an internal server error, which yep. means that You're running it on somebody's machine.
Right. Yeah. It's periodically this happens, and he has a whole series of things that he manages. But yeah, he'll have that up, you know, shortly. It happens probably once every 5 or 6 months for a day or so, and then he gets it back up. So, yeah. But anyway, so yeah, so it's accessible through there. But the website for the band actually is thebandtheroad.com. The name of the band is The Road, and so thebandtheroad.com. And I'm pretty sure that should be up. And in fact, there will be a splash screen with our first album, Drift, is up there. And our second album, Monomyth, will be coming out probably in about 2-3 months. In fact, in next month, February 20th, we're playing a show at the R Bar, which will be the first time we've been back in New York for about 2 years. So that'll be fun.
Where is the R Bar?
It is on, 59th Street. West 59th, and I don't remember the cross street, actually, because I haven't played there before. But it's been remodeled and renovated and so forth. And and it's a good venue with a good acoustic sound. And we're looking forward to it, especially because we have a lot of new material to bring out there, too.
Cool. So. And how do you describe the music?
It is progressive. Depending on who you describe, if you talk to my guitarist, he would say that it's wussy prog. I don't know whether that's fair to say. But it's I like
wussy prog.
Accessible prog.
As opposed to what, Genesis?
Well, right. So, for example, I just happened to see, in fact, Musical Box last week, which is the tribute, basically the Genesis tribute band, but they are licensed to do new Genesis shows of basically recreating all of the early 70s material. So I saw Trick of the Tail, and they do the whole thing with the outfits and the whole bit.
Oh, I was going to ask, because I only just watched some footage of Peter Gabriel wearing the red dress and the wolf head.
Yep. No, and it's astonishing how,
Fox head, right?
How well, not first of all, these are consummate musicians, of course. They have to be if you're going to play early Genesis, but how close the stuff is. You know, he was doing, I saw Trick of the Tail, so he was doing Phil Collins when he took over for Peter Gabriel as the lead singer, and is the same guy who had done the Gabriel singing, and it was really extraordinary. So, yeah, I would say it's less Genesis prog.
That means
prog
he won't be able
more
to do the duets, though.
No, that would be a problem.
Yes.
It's less Genesis prog and more, it's influenced by King Crimson, but there's sort of an influence
that was
that
the
too.
Next
yep.
name I was going to bring up.
Yep.
But, you know, for those who think that King Crimson is accessible,
well, no.
Listen
my
to
guitarist.
Anything except Court of the Crimson King.
Exactly.
You know, and
that's exactly right. Well, as I say, my guitarist has a different vision of the guy who thinks it's wussy prog has a different view of accessible than I do. So I have worked to moderate
his
influence.
Who calls King Crimson wussy has to redefine what a wuss is.
That's correct. So I have tried to modulate his influence. But
yes,
anyway,
indeed.
So but it's been a lot of fun. And and this second album we're excited about, and we hope for good things from it. So
yeah, are there any sample cuts on the website?
Yes, there are.
We can actually play one.
In fact, you'll be able to find.
I see One Small Kindness.
One Small Kindness. That is the whole song. There's that, and there's two others. There's I think on there. There's Breathless, and another one would be All Time, and also Bipolar is another one. Either Bipolar or One Small Kindness might be good options.
It's not on the homepage.
No, it would be on that first splash screen when you first pop it up there.
That is the one.
Yep, and there's a little player that you can actually see.
Yeah, but I only see there One Small Kindness.
Yep, there's a little thing to click over. It looks like a little fast forward thing.
Okay.
Yes.
You see, now I would have assumed that was a fast forward button.
Yep, no, it's a track skipper.
Ah, there we go.
Yep.
Ooh, okay, actually, yes. There's four songs there.
Yep, four total, I believe.
Yeah, there's also All Time.
Yep, All Time's another one.
So, pardon me, after your reading, why don't we play one
Wonderful.
Of those?
That would be great.
Which song would you prefer?
I think One Small Kindness will be good because it has a literary bent to it, actually, so that will be appropriate.
Okay, and let me just make sure it's going to work on this player.
Okay.
Okay, let's just see if I can preview it here. Okay, so far. Oh, yes, there it is.
That's
okay,
it.
Good. Okay.
Wonderful.
Good. So we're all set for that. But you see now, how do I go back and restart it? That's the problem
with
that kind of a player.
You probably can jump back and forth, jump from one track and then go forward again, and you'll get to it, would be my guess. Technology on the fly. This is all my fault for not bringing a CD.
Yeah, we'll manage.
Sounds good.
So we've covered a little bit of you were last on here. What was it?
June.
It was June,
and it was actually the weekend after the Third Sign, my first novel, was released.
That's
published.
Right.
So, Yep. And it's been busy, actually busy since then. There have been a lot of things, you know, personally and professionally and a whole bunch of stuff. On the professional side, the novel is, you know, did pretty well. I got an agent in October, and we have started submitting my second novel, which I will read a little bit the excerpt from, a short excerpt from today, which is called Icarus. I mentioned, I think, in June that I was working on a speculative fiction and politics
speaking
anthology.
Of progressive music, I could have brought Icarus from Paul Winter.
Well, yes, of course. Yes, exactly. If you're going to get the winter, it would be a good one to choose.
Yeah.
So I had been working on a speculative fiction and politics anthology, and I'm still
That's
co-editing
right.
that. And I also have
with
the other
some wonderful people
with some very good people. That is, we're still working on that. Still in search of a publisher. We've had a couple of publishers have really liked it, but the market, which is never good, is still kind of struggling, especially for anthologies, even with really good people involved. So we will get it done eventually, but we still are kind of in the hunt for that. Then I have another. I'm working on a third novel, and the third novel has a character with which I have wrote a short story that is going into a e-anthology with people like Aaron Rosenberg, who did a lot of tie-in novels, does a lot of tie-in novels with Star Wars and Star Trek and so forth. Paul Jeunesse, who released books with Five Star and has a bunch of short stories with Daw. Who else do we have? Barbara Webb and some other people like that. So that is, the names probably aren't as prominent as what we had in the speculative fiction and politics one. But that also is an anthology that's tied together by a common theme. And I'll, mention the common theme at the end of this story that I wrote this for. So that's, moving ahead, professionally. And I'm very pleased about that. And my agent is, very hopeful about the fate of Icarus and books afterwards. So we will see.
Very good.
So that's where I am.
And on the academic side, we should just mention that you are a professor at, is it St. John's?
At St. John's University. In fact, I just got tenure there.
And
so I'm now an associate. Thank you very much. So I'm an associate professor there. And I'm teaching, in fact, this semester.
I've still been meaning to get together, like, all the CUNY people.
You're going to Veronica Chanos at some point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which would be great. That's been going very well. In fact, I teach creative writing and fantasy fiction this very semester. It all ties together, and I mentioned to people that I would be appearing on the show, and some of them said, oh, that's great, and I started listing off your incredible and, matchless list of writers and so forth. Yes, your life list.
Yeah, Rudy Rucker called birders, and I do limited, my wife, she does lots of birding, so I guess by default, because I go with her as well, and I know a little bit about birds.
Right.
So I go birding as well, and when you go birding, you have your life list, which is every bird you've ever seen, you check off,
yep.
And you say, okay, now I've seen, the downy woodpecker. I've seen this one. I've that, and that's
yep.
your life list. And when I showed my list of people who had been on the show to Rudy Rucker, when he was here, he said, "Oh, that's your life list." And so since then,
that completely fits.
So I'm checking off the various writers.
Yep. Now you just need to get pictures of everyone in their natural habitat, and you'll be all set. The Audubon guide to science fiction fantasy writers.
Well, the Peterson's guide anyway. Mm-hmm. Audubon, you have to kill them and stuff them.
That's
first.
Fair enough. Right, right. We don't want to kill this with the writers. That's right.
Not all of them.
Not all of them. Yeah. Right, right.
There are a couple.
Right. Not a rogues gallery, so to speak.
Yes, exactly. the Madame Tussauds gallery of
right.
skiffy writers or
right.
something like that. Now, there's a thought. I mean, don't want to kill them, but to wax them, maybe.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I'm not sure you can come back from that either, but, from that procedure. But,
well,
in
effigy.
Yes. Okay. Well, in that case, I guess it's okay.
Yeah. Now I'm wussing out, but. What the hey?
Right.
But you see, once they're waxed, I can do anything to them I want.
Right. That's true.
Without fear of being cruel.
That's true. I'm just glad that I'm hearing about this, now as a part of this plan, as opposed to being unaware of it. I think you'd want to be a writer who's aware of what's going on, as opposed to being, told about it after the fact. Guess what we're going to do to you? That sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Although some of them probably have premonitions.
Maybe.
And
have written about them. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Right.
No doubt. No doubt.
Right.
So I guess we've covered the main triad of parts of your life.
Parts of my life?
Yeah.
And they have all sort of tied together, you know, over the course of my career. And, it all sort of feeds together in a nice way for me, the music and the writing and the academics. And my university is, I'm fortunate that my university is very supportive of this and has kind of allowed me to, you know, push forward, into this avenue. And I think it has academic value. My creative work has academic value, and I have become increasingly interested in the creative work and the creative side of what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hope they will continue to think that that's a good thing, because I plan to continue doing it. So, you know.
Very good.
Right.
So. Yeah, and it's a wonderful thing that they're giving, that you're, that you have the time.
Right, right. That's right. Yeah, and I have a 2-year-old daughter, too, so time is of the essence always with us.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would say, and you don't want to miss that period.
No. No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, since what you have to read for us is rather lengthy,
yeah,
we should probably dive in.
Okay.
Do you want to take a cut of music first and then go, or?
That's up to you. I don't know if you want to do it and
I'm
then a
okay.
break.
I'm okay. I will go and fetch you some water
okay.
during your reading.
Okay.
So don't mind me as I sneak out of the room
okay.
during your reading. Don't think anything of it. But outside of that, I think if you're ready to
sure.
go.
Sure.
Fine. Then do that.
Okay. That sounds good. I guess I'll do the longer one first. I think that makes sense.
Okay.
This one is written, as I said, for a short story anthology to which I'm contributing with some colleagues and friends of mine. And the theme that ties it all together is each story deals with the subject of a group known as the Crimson Pact, which created a supernatural disaster of some form in the past and is now forced to deal with that entity. Beyond that, whether it's space, fantasy, urban fantasy, epic, you know, you name the type, slipstream, it's up to us what we wanted to do with it. And so this is what I did with my version of that and the story. I'm not entirely happy with the title, which is currently called The Crimson Demon. It could also be called The Agent and the Acolyte, but I don't know. You know, whatever people think, I'll be interested to take on this as well. With a final heave, Gavin threw the man bodily into the street, a string of drunken invective trailing behind him as he flew into the cool night air. "And you'll pay the 3 more coins you owe, for you'll be welcome back, Bennell," the burly man shouted before slamming the door shut and dusting his hands off on his apron with a sigh. The way things had been lately, he hated to lose any customers, let alone regular ones. Money was so tight that he'd had to let his usual muscle go and attend to problems personally. The owner of The Honest Thief had always been loath to give anyone else responsibility for his inn anyway. He'd built and managed it himself for 20 years, and he preferred having control over everything related to it, including order within its walls, which Bennell had disrupted one too many times. But his coin was good, when he remembered to bring it with him. Gavin turned and looked at the half-empty main room, already settling back into its stupor typical of recent evenings, and sighed again. Maybe he could offer some discounts on drinks, or bring in that bard he'd heard playing in the merchant district, who seemed to be popular for no reason that Gavin could understand. Or he could... "You've been here an awful long time, stranger," a guttural voice suddenly said, easily cutting through both the low rumble of conversation in the room and the innkeeper's train of thought. Looking to his right, Gavin felt his heart sink as he saw the source of the disruption. 2 men in leather armor, short swords at their belts, standing over a hooded figure sitting alone at a table at the back of the room. The stranger had indeed been in the inn for several hours, ordering 1 drink and saying nothing since, but quiet strangers in inns were nothing new, and usually not dangerous. The conflicts that usually started from discussions with such people, on the other hand, that was another matter entirely, especially when Darvin's informants, like the 2 armored men, were involved. "I says you've been here an awful long time," the shorter of them said, an unpleasant leer on his face. "You got nowhere to be, I suppose?" The hooded figure said nothing, in fact gave no sign of having heard anything at all. The man who had spoken nudged his taller companion with his elbow. "You see that, Rafe? You got another quiet one here. Just minding his own business, I expect, eh?" The taller man, stubble covering the bottom half of his greasy face, shook his head but said nothing. "No, no, you're probably right," the shorter one said. "It's the quiet ones that tend to mind everyone else's business instead of their own. But you see, it's our job to find out why you're here watching when the rest of us are doing. Assuming there's nothing wrong with your reasons, why, we'll be on our way." The seated stranger remained silent, head motionless, and after a few moments Rafe coughed. "We're wasting our time, Ardor. Darvin'll want to talk to this one himself, I figure. Let's bring him along." Ardor sighed. No one ever wants to come and talk out of courtesy anymore, and it's a shame. What's the city coming to? But I guess you're right. Here now, come along quiet, and we'll make this quick. And he reached for the stranger's arm. Gavin opened his mouth to say something, but hesitated. Folks being run out of his inn by hired thugs was bad for business, but so was standing up to Darwin. But another voice broke in before he could make up his mind. It seems to me he doesn't feel much like going with you lads, the voice, sounding very familiar, said quietly. It came from the shadows in the left side of the room, near the stairs, and as Gavin looked in that direction he remembered whom it belonged to. Leaning against the wall, arms folded, was a man in a dark gray cloak. His face was hooded, but still visible in the flickering torchlight, and as it turned towards Rafe and Ardor, Gavin saw the reflection of steel-gray eyes. Gods, it is him. Seems to me he ain't got much say in the matter, and it ain't your business anyhow, Ardor said with a snarl. So if you don't feel like coming with him, you'll keep your tongue to yourself. The gray-eyed man smiled and said nothing, but he took an almost casual step away from the wall, hands by his sides. Immediately Darvin's men drew their swords and took a step back, the rest of the patrons scattering to the edges of the room as they did so. I hope your friend here appreciates what you're doing for him, Ardor said, because you just walked yourself into trouble. And with a cry he raised his sword for a backhand strike and jumped forward as Gavin opened his mouth to beg for calm. Then everything seemed to happen at once. The man in the gray cloak rolled underneath Ardor's wild slash, and coming to his feet just short of the table the informant had vacated, brought his right arm across his body as he whirled back towards his apparently astonished opponent. Gavin saw a flash of metal, and with a shout of pain Ardor dropped his sword and stumbled backwards, grabbing at his arm. In the same spinning motion the gray-cloaked man ducked underneath another slash aimed at his head by Rafe and punched the taller man in the face, causing him to stagger into the back of a chair as his weapon clattered to the floor. A second later the man in the gray cloak was on him, and with an unceremonious push he deposited Rafe over the chair and onto the stone floor. Kneeling next to his prone body, he held the curved blade of a wicked knife next to his throat as Gavin and the other inn-patrons gaped in astonishment. It had all taken, perhaps, 5 seconds. "Now then," the man in the gray cloak said, not unpleasantly. "My job isn't to wipe the city clean from the vermin which infest it, even Darvin's kind. But I won't have them getting in my way either when I have business to attend to. You tell Darwin that he's done taking people into custody for ransom, information, or worse, or the service will look to him next. Are we clear?" Rafe swallowed and nodded, face wincing in pain. "All right, then," the other man said. "Take your ill-tempered friend." He nodded towards Ardor, who was leaning against the back wall of the inn, trying to stop the flow of blood from his now useless sword arm. "And get out. And that wound will heal, friend," he said to the shorter informant. "The next time I'll make it a permanent fixture of your anatomy." Ardor nodded furiously, and stumbling for a few seconds, finally managed to stand steady on his feet, leaving his sword where it lay. Both he and Rafe made their way past the fallen furniture, and staring at the man in the gray cloak, snuck quickly out of the inn. He watched them go and sheathed his curved blade before turning back to the table, but what he saw there seemed to surprise him. His head swiveled from side to side for a moment, and after a second he looked up and saw Gavin still staring at him. "Where did he go?" he asked the innkeeper. "What?" Gavin stuttered finally. "Where did who—" The other rolled his eyes in exasperation. "The stranger, you fool, the one in the hood, the one who was sitting at this table. Where did he go?" Suddenly Gavin remembered the other hooded stranger whose presence had caused the problems in the first place. "Oh," he replied. "Well, Greyshade, I don't rightly know. He seems to be gone. I was too focused on what was going on between you and Darvin's men already, you see, and I—" But Greyshade was already past him and into the street as Gavin turned to watch him leave, flabbergasted. "But, Greyshade," he finally had the wits to call after a moment, following him outside, "what about my inn? Darvin'll be back to deal with all of this now, and I'll—" Greyshade stopped midway down the street and turned back towards the innkeeper. "No, he won't," he said. "If Darwin has any problems, it will be with me, not you. And as for the rest of what happened—" He frowned, and after a moment he fished in his cloak and drew forth a small silk bag. He tossed it to Gavin, who caught it with a satisfying clink. "Use it for repair and upkeep, not to ask questions, Gavin," Greyshade warned, to which the innkeeper reacted with a stupefied nod. Then with a quick turn and a whirl of his cloak, he was gone. After a few moments, Gavin shook his head in disbelief and opened the bag, which was filled with golden coins. A quick count showed that there would be enough to cover the damage from the fight and well beyond, and as he closed the bag and placed it in his vest pocket, he couldn't help a slight smile in spite of his shock. He'd gotten rid of the strangers, mysterious and otherwise, kept damage resulting from their removal to a minimum, and gotten some free publicity for the honest thief in the bargain. On the whole, the night was beginning to look up, and now maybe he could consider hiring that bard again. Outside, Greyshade strode purposefully along, avoiding the few people he encountered by ducking into the shadows next to a doorway or behind a barrel placed under the edge of a roof to catch the rainwater, scanning the alleys and passageways which fed into the main route through the district like streams into a river. Occasionally his gaze turned upwards as he passed a low-hanging awning or roof, but for the most part he kept his attention at ground level. "If he can fly, he won't be staying on any roof I can see anyway," he muttered to himself, "and we'll have worse problems then." Greyshade had walked the streets of Corell thousands of times before, of course, and could have navigated them blind if he needed to. But here he was tracking a stranger about whom he knew very little, someone who could have the same knowledge about the layout of the city streets as he did, or an outsider who would now be entirely lost, wandering the district aimlessly. Though he doubted this last option was likely. The stranger had been waiting for something or someone in the inn. If the incident with Darvin's people had disrupted the plan, he would surely have gone to a backup meeting place and would know the best route to get there. The destination could be any of a thousand places, public or private, far too many to investigate individually, but perhaps he... Suddenly something flashed at the edge of his vision, and his mind snapped back to the present as he stopped short. He had circled around the entire residential district and was about to walk past the edge of the bridge which led from it to the church district. Looking down below, where the moon illuminated the wide rectangle of grass bordered on three sides by churches and cathedrals extending into the distance, Greyshade saw a cloaked figure hurrying along the road to the larger buildings at the district's far end. As he watched, something around the figure's neck glinted, perhaps a silver clasp for the cloak or a chain or necklace of some kind. Either way, it was an extraordinary stroke of luck, one Greyshade had no intention of passing up. Taking one last look around him, he quickly made his way over the bridge and down the stairs at the far end. Greyshade had lived in the church district for much of his life, and under normal circumstances he would have entered it with his usual reverence. Tall and short buildings lined the roads on both sides of the square, waiting for the worshippers who made daily pilgrimages to pay homage to their particular gods, and he had always loved the peace and order he found here. It was one of the few places where he could forget the chaos which constantly swirled around him. But he had no time for meditation now, and as he fell into line behind the stranger he felt a vague unease. He knew that the district was neither unoccupied nor unguarded, of course, despite the hour and the quiet which pervaded the square. City guards made periodic patrols, and several acolytes of his own order were always posted in ever-changing locations to keep watch. Yet something struck Greyshade as different about the figure he now pursued. He could think of little reason for a meeting to be held here unless a religious order was involved, and that meant trouble of an entirely different kind. But as his mark passed church after church, his concern grew. Where could the meeting be held? If one of the larger sects were involved, the Nazarene cult, say, the situation could be especially dangerous. He started to wonder if his target had become aware of him and was trying to throw him off the scent, and he dropped even further behind to test the theory. But the other gave no indication of noticing his pursuer at all, neither slackening his pace nor changing direction. And then they had reached the end of the square, and only one building remained, and Greyshade knew their final destination. What in the hells is he playing at? They had arrived at the tallest building in the church district, perhaps the tallest in the entire city of Corell, Argoth's Cathedral. Its roofs and towers dwarfed those of the churches near it, and its central spire soared skyward. Circular stained glass windows, each with an image of Argoth's hammer, were set at regular intervals down each side wall, formed from hand-hewn blocks of dark stone. It was a building which represented strength and purpose, unswerving commitment to the path of justice which a life in Argoth's service required, and for the better part of 20 years Greyshade had called it his home. During the day members of the order passed in and out of its entrance, guarded by two imposing doors, each inset with a large handle of iron, and visitors of all faiths, and some with no faith at all, would come and go on various business. But at night the portal was closed, and few would even dare approach the building. Yet the stranger ascended the wide stairs leading to the front doors without hesitation, and as he stopped in front of the sealed entrance, Greyshade slid smoothly into the shadows cast by the roof of the nearest building to watch. After a second the hooded figure raised his hands and spoke several soft words, and with a slight shudder the doors swung inward. "Knows the passphrase," Greyshade muttered as the stranger passed into the cathedral. "How did—" He trailed off and shook his head, then set his mouth in a firm line and made for the doors, slipping inside just as they began to close. Inside, Greyshade spotted his mark about halfway down the long entrance hallway, dimly illuminated by torches alternating with pictures of scales and a hammer. Now he was becoming worried. Surely an acolyte should have stopped the stranger by now, yet he continued his journey unimpeded. Did he do something to the guards? The object which had first caught Greyshade's attention near the entrance to the district flashed again as the man passed by the torch at the far end of the passage, and as he entered the main sanctuary beyond it, the pursuer quickened his pace. Entering the large hall several seconds after the stranger, Greyshade looked to his left and saw his quarry heading down the nearest hallway towards a simple wooden door with an iron ring set in its middle. With a knock and a push, the stranger entered, and muttering a curse, Greyshade sprinted after him. With one last burst of speed, he made it through the door before it closed, and as he slid to a stop, he drew his kukuri and pointed it at the back of the stranger, who stood motionless in front of a wooden desk. "That's as far as you go, friend," Greyshade said. "You've got 3 seconds to tell me who you are and how you got in here, or I'll lose interest in the answers and kill you where you stand." "Do you think I might have a say in that, acolyte?" a mild voice inquired. And with a start, Greyshade looked up to see a man of medium height, with sandy brown hair, standing behind the desk, the slightest of smiles on his face. "Of course, Father Esper," Greyshade said with a nod and a short bow, his kukuri still pointed at the hooded figure. "But when the stranger just waltzed into the cathedral without a single word of challenge, I became worried, the more so since you sent me to watch him. Earlier this evening he had a run-in with two of Darvin's people at the Honest Thief, and I—" "Yes, I heard something about that," Esper said. "And I heard that some of the more notable acts of the evening took place between those two people and a certain acolyte of Argoth, once he had grown tired of their foolishness." Greyshade scowled. "It wasn't foolishness which concerned me, Father." "Is he always so sure of himself, Esper?" said the hooded figure suddenly in a surprisingly high voice. Esper smiled quietly. "Sometimes. But he takes strength from his confidence." "Confidence or arrogance, I wonder," the stranger said. "It wasn't arrogance that bested Darvin's men, stranger," Greyshade said, his grip on his curved blade tightening. "You wouldn't be here to mock a servant of the Order of Argoth otherwise." The hooded figure's head tilted slightly. "Are you certain of that, acolyte?" came the reply at last. "Are you certain you know all the facts?" And as the stranger turned and used one gloved hand to push back the hood, revealing auburn hair pulled neatly into a ponytail, Greyshade's eyes widened. His mark was a woman. "May I introduce Eldsman Chander, acolyte?" Esper said, a faint grin still touching the edges of his mouth. "Though it appears you've already met, in a fashion." Eldsben arched one of her eyebrows sardonically. "Indeed," she replied. "Even though I'm not half the man he expected me to be, it appears." Greyshade blinked and shook his head. "I expected only what I was told to expect, and that involved a member of a dangerous cult, not a strange woman masquerading as one. Father, you knew of this deception?" Esper opened his mouth to reply, but Elsbend laughed. "Is that what they're calling us these days, a cult? It's too bad. There was a time we might have qualified as one, I suppose." She reached up to her neck to finger a silver medallion, which was shaped like a crescent moon, inset with several rubies. It was obviously this which had flashed in the light and caught Greyshade's attention. "Everyone has their own definitions, Elsbend," Esper said mildly. "I've heard the Crimson Pact called worse than a cult." "And I've heard the Order of Argoth called better than a den of murdering cutthroats," Elsbend shot back. "But a lie is still a lie, define it how you will." "Mind your tongue in front of the head of the service, or I'll mind it for you," Greyshade said in a low growl. Elsbend whirled on him, dark brown eyes flashing, but Esper cut in before she could speak. "That will be enough out of both of you, if you please," he said in a tone which Greyshade knew brooked no contradiction. The head of Argoth's service was unfailingly mild-mannered and pleasant, but more than one enemy had made the mistake of reading such qualities as signs of weakness, and had paid a steep price for the error. Whenever Father Esper decided the time had come to protect the Order of Argoth, he did so with neither hesitation nor halfway measures. But he also never acted out of malice, a fact which many suspected distinguished him from a number of his predecessors in his position. It was Esper who had first brought Greyshade into the service years ago, and more than anyone else, even more than his trainer Chaosthenes, it was to Esper that Greyshade owed his allegiance. "Elsbend is here at her request, and my invitation, Greyshade, and she stays at my pleasure. Put that kukuri away and sit down. As for you, Elsbend, my acolyte is here because I wish him to be, and that ought to be enough for you. Leave your mockery outside where it belongs." Greyshade bowed and complied with Esper's order, though not without one last glare at Elsbend as he sat down in one of the two wooden chairs facing the desk. Elsbin nodded curtly and took the other seat, ignoring the acolyte completely. Esper smiled and sat down in his seat behind the desk, hands folded. Better. All right, Elsbin. I think it would be helpful if we all knew the situation we're dealing with as you understand it. As I understand it? Elsbin repeated quizzically. This isn't a matter of opinion, Esper. Surely you've heard of the danger involved here. Esper leaned back in his chair. Let us say I have not heard of it. What is the nature of this danger? Elsbin shook her head and sighed. As you will. She leaned back and shot a sideways glance at Greyshade. Have you heard of the Crimson Pact, acolyte? Greyshade shrugged. Vaguely. I remember hearing something about an organization which dealt in demonic possessions or sacrifices in exchange for dark powers, that sort of thing. But it died out years ago. Elsbin laughed. Yes, that's the tale usually told, she said, her tone still faintly mocking to Greyshade's ears despite Esper's admonition. But as is usually the case in such things, the truth is both closer to and farther from what the stories say. First, the Crimson Pact never died out, or at least not entirely. Initially, it was to its advantage for others to believe it had gone. Later, it was partially true, or at least true compared to what the pact was at its beginning. But it still exists to this day, and I am its chief agent. And what is its purpose today? Greyshade asked. Elsbin chuckled. I said I am its agent, not its betrayer, she replied. Our business is our own. Would you reveal the motivations for your order to strangers, if indeed you even knew what the motivations were? My order wouldn't send me to beg for help from strangers in the first place, Greyshade replied hotly. Peace, Esper said, raising one hand in warning as Elsbin opened her mouth to retort. Such sniping is pointless. But even though he speaks in anger, Elsbin, there is some truth in what he says. You've asked for help from the order, and I must decide if such help will be forthcoming. Given the circumstances, I don't think secrecy is your best course. When you hear the circumstances, you'll stop thinking of this as a mercy mission, Esper. This affects all of us, Elsbin replied. But as you will. Say that the Crimson Pact was intrigued in the supernatural, otherworldly creatures and items. It sought out the unusual, the unexplainable, the unknown. The fanciful, Greyshade asked, allowing a tinge of mockery to slip into his own voice this time. But Elsbin either didn't notice or chose not to take the bait. Perhaps, she said. But when it was founded, members of the Crimson Pact believed that there were some things which could not be explained through rational inquiry, that there was a world we could not understand, access to which would bring great power. They saw nothing fanciful about that prospect. And now? Esper asked. The interest in the unexplainable and the power connected to such things remains, Elsbin said. But the Pact had left its more primitive superstitions behind. Had left them? Greyshade said, and the Crimson Pact agent glared at him. But after a moment her gaze wavered, and she stood and turned away from the desk, looking up into space. After a long moment she sighed and shook her head. I had. With what we've learned recently, I'm not sure I would dismiss anything out of hand anymore. She sighed again. There have always been disputes among members of the Crimson Pact about how literally they ought to take their commitment to the world beyond. The majority of the Founders were content to search for evidence of the other world in this one and leave it at that. But a few of them weren't satisfied, and demanded ever greater knowledge and access to things which were better left alone. Wanting turn of events, Esper, probably not, earned a 5 years additional. It is really that become powered ever next. Things become hazy. Most current members of the Pact know little of what I am about to tell you. Even our leader, Ezel Coliban, knows only bits and pieces, and those based partially on hearsay and rumor. But the gist of it is this. The breakaway members had formed their own small sect, dedicated to returning to the core principles of the Crimson Pact as they understood them. Greed for demonic power, Greyshade said, expecting a rebuke. But to his surprise, she merely nodded. Yes, simply stated. But it was more than that. The dissidents had become convinced that to truly access power from the demonic world, they needed to bring a part of it into this one, literally. Summoning, you mean, Esper said quietly. Greyshade chuckled and quickly stopped as he saw the serious look on Elsman's face. Yes. The Crimson Pact was named for the demon reputed to be most interested in other worlds to begin with. After the members split from the requests for disappearance, the Pact's leader asked until he had fought on summoning. It said, hover, you might have to be but complete. And when nothing happened, Fact breathed a sigh of relief. We assumed the crisis had been averted. Stories of the split were suppressed to discourage further divisions and decades passed. Eventually, the story became legend, and then it was finally forgotten altogether. So much for history, Elsbin, Esper said with a slight frown. But you haven't yet said what a failed ritual 100 years ago has to do with today, or us. Elsbin's face was grim. That's because the ritual may not have failed after all. Grayshade raised an eyebrow as she returned to her chair and sat down heavily. 2 months ago we began to find members of the Crimson Pact either missing or dead. The first group was small in number, but it included all of those who had publicly disagreed with Ezel's leadership. The second was notable less for the deaths themselves than for the way they happened, savagely, brutally, as if the victims had been literally ripped to pieces. At first, Ezel believed that an outside force was involved, trying to destroy what was left of us one member at a time. He assumed your order was behind the killings at first. Why? Because we act as butchers? Grayshade said incredulously. No, because you think your job is to enforce order and justice whether others would have it or not, Elsbin said with more than a touch of anger. But after we investigated further, she went on hurriedly before either Esper or Grayshade could interject, we discovered information linking the attacks back to the missing Pact members and the safe house in Corell from which they operated. This had nothing to do with the rival organization. The attack came from within. I see, Esper said. So Ezel Kolobon believes that members of the Crimson Pact have broken away from the main group just as it happened 100 years ago and are now killing their former colleagues. That's regrettable, I'm sure. But we're not for hire, Elsbin. When it comes to external matters, we only become involved when your own security is threatened. Yes, I know, Elsbin broke in impatiently. It's all very noble of you to kill only when your own interests are at risk. But we've come to you precisely because they are at risk, Esper, yours and everyone else's. She leaned closer to the desk and lowered her voice. These killings don't seem human in nature. And Ezel has come to believe that the ritual we thought had been stopped 100 years ago was merely delayed and has now been completed. You're mad, Grayshade said. You think that Balos has been summoned, Acolyte. Yes, we believe the Crimson Demon walks the earth. And if he does, your precious order will be as much threatened as ours. She folded her arms as both men stared at her. It's your choice whether to help us or not, Esper. But if you don't help, how long will it take before Balos runs through what is left of the Crimson Pact, gaining more power with every kill he makes and every artifact he retrieves, and looks for a new target? How long will it be before he comes for you? Part 2. It was early next morning when Elsbin and I set out for the safe house from which the breakaway Crimson Pact members were believed to be operating, and as we made our way over the bridge leading from the church to the residential district, there was little conversation between us. I hadn't made a good impression on her during the meeting with Esper the night before, evidently, and as for me, I was none too pleased about being asked to handle a mission with someone else. I preferred to work alone, especially when the alternative was pairing with someone I neither trusted nor cared for. Oh, in some ways she was an intriguing challenge. I had to admit that Elsbin could spin a good tale, for example, however ridiculous I considered it. It wasn't I rejected the possibility of worlds other than our own. I'd seen some strange things during my time in Argoth's service, and not all of them could be explained as figments of a young and overactive imagination. But what I had really learned during my time fulfilling the Order's will was that simple explanations tended to be far more likely than complicated ones, and supernatural powers were only that way until you found the human being pretending to have them. In my experience, men were far more dangerous than demons, and much more easily persuadable. So the idea that a demon could have returned to walk among us thanks to a 100-year-old ritual and a few crazed cultists, and, even if true, that this demon could threaten everyone in the city of Corell if allowed to wipe out his immediate target of the Crimson Pact, was absurd in the extreme. No, the last thing we needed was to get caught in the middle of a civil war between two parts of an organization in its death throes, and so I fully expected Father Esper to reject Elsbin's request out of hand. Instead, he leaned back in his chair after she had made her plea, one hand supporting his chin as always when he was deep in thought. After a minute of silence, he sighed. All right, Elsbin, he said. I'm not sure how much of this story I can believe, and I don't know what information you're leaving out. My guess is not all and at least a little. But there's enough truth in what you say to convince me that there's something here which could concern the Order of Argoth. So I'm going to send Grayshade with you to deal with the problem. Elsbin and I both stood up. Him? She said incredulously. You face a threat of this kind, and your response is to send one of your novices? The term is apprentice, Esper said calmly, and Grayshade is no longer one. He's now an acolyte, one of the most promising in Argoth's service. I'm sending someone whom I trust. I appreciate the compliment, Father, I cut in, but I don't see what the point is in all this. If we can't let the Crimson Pack deal with its own problems, why send me? An apprentice could use the training. Let one of them remove whatever delusional fanatic is pretending to be Balos. Delusional fanatic? Elsman said, turning on me in a fury. This isn't some mortal masquerading as the Crimson Demon, you fool! I opened my mouth to respond, but Esper raised his hand and stood to face us. Enough, he said. The decision is made. Elsman, this is the help I'm willing to give you. Take it or not as you wish. But I'd advise you not to underestimate this acolyte's talent. And I doubt that your superior would be pleased if you returned to him empty-handed when an offer of assistance was made. The crimson-packed agent's face was red with anger, but after a second she shrugged. So be it, she said as she raised her hood to cover her face once more. We leave tomorrow morning for the safe house, acolyte, she said, turning to me. I'll be here at the sixth bell. Don't make me wait. And with the briefest of nods to Esper, she turned on her heel, opened the door, and passed through without looking back. As the door closed behind her, Esper sighed and sat down. Her temper is the same color as her organization, it seems, I said, looking at the closed door. If this is the way all of the Crimson Pact members act, there's little wonder it's tearing itself apart. Perhaps, Esper said, but I know a certain acolyte of Argoth who sometimes has difficulty keeping his anger in check, too. Listen to me, Greyshade, he went on as I frowned. I doubt that Valos himself is returned, or that he poses a threat to us if he has. But I've heard reports of these killings, too, and anyone eliminating targets without our knowledge is a potential danger. Whoever is pretending to be Balos is either doing this himself or has convinced others to do it for him, and in either case he can't be allowed to operate with impunity. I want you to find him, whoever he is, and eliminate him. I nodded. As you say, Father. But I'd work better by myself. Sending her along is likely to slow me down. Esper shook his head. Under normal circumstances I would agree, but this isn't a normal situation. First of all, Elsbin knows the layout of the safe house better than anyone from the outside, and it would take you time to learn the same knowledge for yourself. That's time we don't have. This situation troubles me, and I want it dealt with quickly. Second, I had you follow her here for a reason. I wanted more information about her, and I still do. You don't trust her? I asked. I do, as far as it's safe to do so. It's your job, in part, to find out how far that actually is. And this will be a good test for you, Greyshade. There are some in the service, you know, who aren't sure I made the right decision in elevating you to acolyte so soon. I'll prove them wrong, Father, I said, clenching my fist. Esper smiled. Just complete your mission. The doubters will take care of themselves. And so here I was, walking in silence with Elsman. Her hood was down for the moment. She was apparently not as concerned about being seen as she had been last night. And as we passed through the streets of the residential district, I looked at her curiously. High cheekbones and eyebrows gave her a vaguely aristocratic appearance, and despite a few fine lines around her eyes, there was a freshness to her face which suggested energy and vitality. But her expression was closed, eyes narrowed, mouth pursed, brow furrowed either in concentration or annoyance. It was a face both attractive and off-putting, and I wondered what events in her past might have helped create the combination. "Are you done perusing my features, acolyte?" she said suddenly as we took a right onto Market Street. "I hope what you find there is acceptable enough to keep your blade from my back until after we complete our task." "Annoyance it is," I thought, and laughed. "You're too suspicious, Elsman. I'm here to help you, not hurt. Unless you determine I pose a threat to the Order, in which case you'll wipe me from this plane without a second thought," she replied. "Comforting. Is that what you think we do, kill based on whimsy or malice?" I shook my head as we traced our way around an overturned cart and its contents, its owner yelling loudly at the hapless beggar who must have gotten in the way and caused the accident. "Argoth's not a sadistic god," I continued. "We believe that justice is balance. All we do is return the scale to true when it's tipped too far in one direction or the other." "Oh, spare me your slogans," she sneered. "Justice is a pleasant fiction to live by when you're the ones deciding who measures up to the definition. But for the rest of us..." She punctuated the word rest with a vicious kick at a street urchin who scrambled out of the way with a squeak. "Well, the rest of us have to get by as best we can and let other authorities make their decision about our ultimate fates." "It seems unfair to you," I said. "It doesn't to you?" she asked, looking at me for the first time. I measured my reply carefully. "In a way. But my trainer Chaosthenes showed me that life isn't fair. It was never intended to be. We don't seek perfect equality of result. All we can do is level the field of play, just a bit at a time." Elsbin snorted but said nothing, and as we walked in silence again for another minute. "What if you're wrong?" she asked finally. "What if, by helping to tip the scale, you actually go too far, or you send it in the wrong direction completely?" I shrugged. "Then we correct, adjust, we tip the scale back. And what about the ones who were harmed before you make your correction?" "We try to keep the harm to a minimum, Elsbin," I said, growing irritated. "And you've said nothing about your own organization's motivations. The Crimson Pact is hardly free from taint. If you're so disgusted with the Order of Argoth, why did you ask for our help? Why not handle things yourselves?" Elsbin shook her head, her lips closed tightly. We were just coming to the gate which led from the residential to the merchant district, and she stopped as the flag signaling the district entrance came into view. After a few seconds, she sighed. "Because, Acolyte, we had no other options. Your order runs much of this city, officially or not, and no one is better at solving a problem in it, or removing an enemy from it, than your people. As for us..." She looked at the sky, then back at me, dark eyes flashing. "There are few of us remaining to handle anything, let alone something which would destroy everything we have left. What would you do, Acolyte, if your order, if everything you knew, was close to extinction? What would you be willing to do to protect who you were?" And with a final furious glare, she pulled her hood over her head and strode off towards the gate so quickly I had to almost jog to keep up with her, her question echoing in my mind. We kept a somewhat slower pace through the merchant district, partly from necessity. It was considerably more crowded than the residential, even at this hour, and partly from design. The safe house was nearly dead center of the district, and Elsbin said that the closer we came, the larger the risk of running into more of Balos's people. This was, of course, exactly why I normally plan missions for night, but Elsbin was convinced that daytime was safer, particularly where a demon was concerned. I made no comment, but her scowl told me that I hadn't kept my expression as neutral as I had intended. So daytime it was, but even going more slowly and trying to keep a low profile, we reached the building just as the eighth bell was sounding. It was an unremarkable wooden structure, narrow and deep as was the typical design of many of the buildings in this part of the city, flanked by similar-looking storehouses on either side. It could have held anything from silk to mageberry wine to resin stone, but if Elsbin was right, it held something considerably more significant than any of those goods. As I peered out from our vantage point about three alleyways south of the building, I could see two lightly armed guards with short swords standing in front of the main entrance, a large wooden door on its outside. The street was otherwise entirely deserted. "Hmm," I said quietly. "Waiting for a shift change makes the most sense. They probably switch at the 12th bell. If we..." "We don't have time to wait 4 hours," Elsbin broke in urgently. "Every moment we wait is giving Balos time to grow stronger." I sighed, trying not to roll my eyes. "It'll make little difference how much weaker he is now than later if we can't get to him in the first place," I pointed out. "There has to be another way," she insisted. I peered out again. "All right," I said, looking back at the Pact agent. "I'll draw them away. But watch for others and be ready to move on my signal. We'll need to get inside as quickly as possible after neutralizing them in case any other patrols swing by." Elsbin nodded. I looked back out, concentrated on the street to the north, and then tapped on the wooden wall to the building next to me. The guards started and looked to their right, and after a few moments both went in the direction of the sound, precisely where I had shifted it to, of course. "Amateurs," I muttered under my breath, and nodding to Elsbin, I slid from my place and drew my kukuri as I silently sprinted towards the guards. Both were standing with their backs to me in front of the first alley to the north of the safe house, peering down its length to see if they could spot the source of the sound. As I reached the first one, I reversed my blade and raked the hilt across the back of the man's head, and without a sound, he crumpled to the street. The other turned and opened his mouth to cry out a warning, but I was already next to him. My kukuri's hilt hit him square in the stomach, and as he doubled over with the wind knocked out of him, I brought it up into his face. He fell with a thud, and an eerie silence settled back onto the street. "Greyshade!" someone hissed, and I turned to see Elsbin coming up behind me with her sword drawn. "What are you doing?" I asked. "Finishing them off," she said as she reached me, face slightly flushed. "Not with me, you won't," I said, reaching out and pushing her blade down with mine. She stared at me in apparent disbelief. "Are you mad? These are Balos's people. When they wake, they'll have the alarm sounded, and every madman and demon in the place will be after us." "First, these ones won't be awake for several hours, and by then we'll be long gone," I said. "Unless you're taking me to some demon plane yourself, this building isn't all that large, and it won't take very long to get through it. Second, I don't kill those I don't need to. These ones aren't our target." "But they're allied with him. What kind of cowardice is this?" Elsbin said angrily. I raised an eyebrow. There's nothing brave about killing unconscious men, and there's nothing cowardly about avoiding killing when you can, especially so long as surviving family members still harbor thoughts of revenge, and believe me, most of them usually do, I replied. Neither you nor I have any idea what motivated these people anyway, even if they are Ballos's people, and not some pathetic mercenaries hoping for a bit of extra coin they can waste at a tavern when they get off work. Anyone who can be that easily fooled by a simple sound-shifting technique isn't likely to be highly trained. That's the end of it, Elsbin, I said firmly as she looked ready to say something further. Help me get them out of the way, and let's get inside. I sheathed my kukri and bent down to grab the shoulders of the first guard. Foolishness, she said with a scowl, but she sheathed her sword and helped me pull the two bodies into the alley in front of which they had been standing. We deposited them behind a large crate, and I quickly searched both bodies. Nothing, I said. Evidently they weren't meant to be able to get inside, which makes it even more likely they're just hired help. Still, that means we need another way in. No, no, we don't, Elsbin said with the same irritation in her voice, and she returned to the main door in the street as I trailed behind. She looked at the iron ring set in its middle, then took a curious U-shaped object from beneath the folds of her cloak. Placing it upon the iron ring, she put her free hand on the door itself and closed her eyes. Amalorak, she chanted quietly. Amalorak Marlum. An agonized screech came from inside the door, and with a loud snap it popped open, swinging inwards. The metal tongue of the door lock had been twisted in half. Elsbin opened her eyes and looked at me with the trace of a smile as she retrieved the strange object and replaced it within her cloak. Clever, I said, especially if you want to attract the attention of every guard within 1,000 feet to your presence. The smile vanished. I don't see any guards here, and this is faster besides. I shrugged. You generally don't survive with luck twice without admitting it saved you once. Close what's left of that door behind you, will you? I said as I walked past her into the hall, ignoring her murderous glare. I had been told to work with her after all, but I didn't have to like it, or her. The entire first floor seemed to be one long hallway leading to a door at its end, and as far as I could tell, it was empty. We probably need to access the second floor through another entrance into the building, I said. Yes, but we're heading downwards to the basement, Elsbin replied. My information suggests that Ballos is living below ground so as to avoid easy detection. Naturally, I said dryly, my eyes scanning ceiling, floor, and walls as we walked. Of course, he might also decide that that's where everyone will go to look for him, so he should try for something more obscure. But then... I stopped short and held up an arm to block Elsbin's path. Wait. You see the rug? Yes, she said, looking down at the alternating bands of red and black colors which covered the rug, stretching nearly the entire length of the hallway. I see nothing wrong with it. No, unless you count placing a fairly obvious trap as wrong, I said with a slight chuckle, and drawing my kukri, I bent down and lay the blade flat on the rug. I eased it forward until it touched and broke a nearly invisible thread stretched across the width of the hallway right above the ground. There was an audible click, and a large circular blade arced down from the ceiling, neatly bisecting the air 5 feet in front of us, before returning to its original position and locking in place again. Elsbin looked at me, her eyes slightly widened. I smiled. No need for guards when trapped floors serve the purpose, I said. There will probably be 2 more of these before the door itself. Stay behind me, and don't move too quickly. But in fact there was only 1 more of the blades, and after triggering it in safety, we traversed the rest of the distance without difficulty. I stood as we reached the door and sheathed my kukri. I ran my fingers along the door frame, carefully eyed the iron handle set in its left side, and lightly tapped the door's hinges, finally putting my ear to the door itself before standing back. I thought this was supposed to be a safe house, but for demonic cultists, your breakaway members seem rather lazy in rigging their defenses, I observed. Or does all of the Pact have trouble affording basic methods to secure its buildings? Elsbin's face flushed, and I could tell I had touched a nerve. The Pact's strongholds have always been well protected, perhaps as well as your own. Not well enough to keep your people from being killed, I thought, but decided not to verbalize the idea. Well, perhaps they become more dangerous lower, but thus far I'm most disappointed. And lifting the handle with a smile, I pulled the wooden door outwards. Immediately we felt something around us change, and Elsbin took a step back as a draft of dank, cold air flowed into the hallway. A set of wooden stairs led downwards from the door into the darkness, though I could see that some kind of light source pierced the gloom at regular intervals. I looked at Elsbin, who seemed a trifle pleased with herself, and shaking my head I began my descent with the agent right behind. The stairs were steep, but relatively straight, and for a time they were easy to navigate. The light sources on the walls seemed to be made of some kind of natural stone which radiated phosphorescent light at surprising intensity, helping guide us from stair to stair. But as the air grew colder and more damp, the footing became treacherous, and at one point I took a step and found myself nearly losing my balance as my foot went out from under me. I caught myself and looked down. I had stepped on a stair made of stone, not wood, and the remainder of the stairs were formed from the same kind of rough, now damp, material. In fact, the whole area seemed to have been hewed from stone, and as we were starting to near the bottom, I could see the hallway had opened out into a large cavern. The air had become bitterly cold, and I felt a slight twinge of unease. "Oh, this all seems quite straightforward," Elsbin said, her voice dripping with sarcasm. "Indeed, this is all quite normal for a typical building with typical inhabitants, isn't it?" I frowned. "I give them credit for a good costume, but I haven't seen anything yet to tell me that the body underneath isn't human." Elsbin shook her head and pushed her way past me. "All the evidence is there if you're not too blind to see it," she said over her shoulder as she walked down the last few stairs. I chuckled as I followed her, but inside I had to admit there was something unusual here, demonic or otherwise. The cavern itself was surprisingly large, extending well beyond the foundation on which the building above it sat, and it was mostly bare. There were a few crates along the walls here and there, and the same luminescent sources we had seen on our way down the stairs were embedded in the walls, but otherwise there was little of note or value we could see. But there were sounds. I attributed a periodic dripping noise to the overall dampness of the ceiling and walls, and an occasional soft tapping had to be a pebble bouncing to a stop in the ground. But as we slowed our pace to better take in our surroundings, we heard something else, a faint moaning or crying coming from the northwest part of the cavern. "It's a ritual," Elsbin hissed. "Balos's demonic servants." I drew my kukuri. "Ritual, maybe. Demons, no. Those are human voices," I said, and headed towards the sound, carefully picking my way among the loose stones on the cavern floor. As we got closer and the voices grew louder, it became clear that at least 8 or 9 were chanting in a regular cadence, pitch rising and falling in unified rhythm. A minute later, we reached the northwest corner of the cavern. 2 rock outcroppings bent in from the northern and western walls, creating a kind of natural enclosure from which the sound was emanating, and a closed stone door stood in the middle of the northern side of the enclosure. As we knelt behind the outcropping to the west, we could see that Elsbin had been correct about the first part of her prediction. This was indeed a ritual of some kind. 8 figures in dark red robes stood around a natural rock pillar, chanting in unison as one robed figure stood on the pillar's top, head thrown back, arms lifted to the roof, a naked dagger in his hand. "Do you recognize what they're chanting?" I whispered. "No," Elsbin whispered back, "but we need to stop it before they complete their ritual." There was a strange edge to her voice, and I looked back to see what was wrong. Her face, bathed in the weird shadows cast by the central figure's movement in front of the lights, had a desperate intensity, and her weight was shifted forward on one knee like a cat ready to pounce. "Elsbin, what?" I began to ask, but without warning she sprang forward towards the light, and I saw a metallic flash reflecting from her hand. The robed figures turned in surprise, and the ones near the back drew blades. The figure on the top of the pillar shouted a challenge as he jumped to the ground. So much for a quiet entrance, I thought, and with a curse I leaped from my hiding place. Much of the attention was on the agent, of course, so I was on the 2 cultists closest to me before they knew what was happening. My kukuri hilt laid them flat, and I spun just in time to see a sword slash headed for my midsection. I fell backwards as the blade swung through the air above me and swept the legs of my attacker out from under him. The back of his head hit the ground with a thud, and with a groan he slipped into unconsciousness. Another robed assailant was already driving his sword down towards me, but I was back to one knee, and I jerked back as the weapon point missed my face by inches. I grabbed the hilt, pulled it and its holder down to the ground, where I knocked him out with a swift blow to the skull. 4 down. I came to my feet, with another charging at me, and from the inside of my cloak I arced my hand forward, releasing my reshtar at the apex of the movement. It whirled towards the cultist, who dodged left as it flew past him. He shouted in triumph, but I simply smiled, and as the cultist lifted his knife to strike me, there was a loud thunk. His smug expression froze, and his body went rigid, and he toppled to the ground with a crash as I ducked out of the way. "A reshtar doesn't need to hit the first time, friend," I murmured as I picked up the weapon and returned it to its place within my cloak as I surveyed the scene. I had already taken down 5 of the cultists, and it appeared Elsbin had eliminated 3 more whose bodies lay strewn about her. Now she was locked in combat with a man who had been standing on the pillar, and as I sprinted towards them, the light flashing from their blades as they struck and parried was almost blinding. From my robe I drew 3 kushuri darts, and I flung them towards the cultist with a shout. He looked in my direction for a split second, and for a moment I caught a glimpse of his face, strained and wet-covered, eyes wide. Then the darts hit his sword hand, and with a cry he dropped his weapon and clutched his wrist in agony. Elsbin drew her sword back, eyes flashing, and before I could yell to stop her, she drove it into his chest. Without another sound, he toppled backwards to the ground, dead before he hit. "Thanks," she said, slightly breathless, light glinting from her pendant. "I assumed you could handle yours, and—" But she stopped as she saw from the expression on my face I was in no mood for conversation. "Yes, I could," I replied, as I sheathed my kokori and retrieved my kashuri darts, stowing them in their place within my cloak. "And I could have handled yours, too. In fact, I could have handled all of them, given a bit of time, without killing them and creating more potential enemies in the process." The agent lifted her chin into a defiant angle. "I told you before, we don't have much time, and none of these traitors deserve to live. I'm not a mercenary, Elsbin, and I won't be a tool for your vengeance. If you're hell's bent on killing these minions, you can do it without me. My mission is to eliminate Balos, whoever he actually is, and that's all I intend to do." "And do you intend for me to wait politely while you fulfill your mission, assassin?" a deep voice said. And drawing my kokori again as I turned, I saw the door on the opposite side of the enclosure had opened. Standing in front of it was a tall, broad-shouldered man, robes colored a darker red than those of the others we had just fought. But his hood was back, and as we looked at him, we saw his hair and neatly trimmed beard was white, though he himself looked younger than Father Esper. A golden chain ending in a strangely shaped symbol, looking like two crescent moons made of crystal placed back to back, hung about his neck, and in one hand he held a long, curved sword. Elsbin's face flushed red with anger as she saw him, and she slowly crouched into a fighting stance with her blood-stained blade stretched out towards him. "Balos," she said in a strangled voice, "your time and influence on this plane has come to an end, along with your life." And with a shout of murderous fury, she ran towards him. But his expression did not change, and as she closed on him, her arm lifted for the killing stroke, he lifted his free hand to the chain around his neck. Grabbing the symbol, he intoned a single word. "Balosin," he said. Instantly, Elsbin's body froze as if suspended in space, her sword arm held above her, her face contorted in its same expression of unreasoning rage. The man smiled and released the symbol, though he kept his sword raised in the other hand. "So predictable, Elsbin. Always so predictable," he chuckled as he walked up to her and looked into her face. "I thought the Crimson Pact might have learned to change its plan of attack by now." He sighed and turned to me. "And what of you, Acolyte? Do you still intend to fulfill your mission?" I narrowed my eyes as we faced each other, kokori held in front of me, balancing my weight evenly on the balls of my feet as I had been trained to do. "I do as I must," I said at last, taking several wary steps to my right while my gaze remained fixed on his. "Are you the Crimson Demon?" The man threw back his head and laughed. "I am Balos," he said after his laughter died down. "As for being a demon, I don't have that honor, though some of my followers call me one out of respect." "Or fear," I replied, continuing to move step by step to my right, pivoting slowly away from both him and the motionless body of Elsbin, light glinting from the pendant around her neck. "You seem to command much of that. Small wonder given the deaths you've caused." "Me?" Balos laughed in surprise. "Is that what they've told you?" "I'm flattered, but really, I'm not responsible for any lives except the ones given freely to me in my service, and those are volunteers working in my name, not on my orders." "Then you deny targeting the members of the Crimson Pact for death?" I asked. Something felt odd here, but I couldn't place my finger on exactly what. "Oh, I'd like them to die," Balos replied easily. "So should you, if you knew the full story behind them. But no, I haven't targeted them specifically, and it might be harder to do so now, given that you've disrupted our spell." "It doesn't seem to have affected all of your powers," I said, glancing at Elsbin for a split second as I took two more careful steps to the right. "Given who she is, this is child's play," he said with a laugh. "But don't worry, you've slowed us down considerably in the short term. In the long term, well, there's not much you can do about that, I'm afraid. We do need to finish what we've started. I'm sorry that you'll have to disappoint your Argoth." "I don't intend to disappoint him," I said grimly. "And I don't intend to let you finish anything. Because if you could have stopped me the way you did Elsbin, you would have already done it." And I swung my free arm away from the inside of my cloak, letting my kashuri darts fly. Balos's sword arced down as he ducked, and the blade deflected the darts, but I was already on him, my kokori aimed for his neck. He dodged out of the way with stunning speed and drove the hilt of his blade into my stomach. I doubled over, trying to catch my breath, but as he brought the other side of his sword up, I managed to lean out of the way and aim a kick at his knee. As it connected, he shouted in pain and fell back, and as I moved away to give myself more room, I threw my reshtar towards him. He dodged and spun, and as I watched, he used his blade to parry the reshtar in its return flight, harmlessly to the floor. I fell to one knee, still gasping for air, and with a smile he strolled towards me, stopping a few feet away with his sword held at my throat. "It's honestly a shame to do this, acolyte. You honor your god with your skill, and we could have used you. But this is too important to let anyone interfere." Around his neck the golden reverse moon sparkled in the light. "I understand," I said, between coughs. His smile shifted slightly, and his eyes narrowed as he pulled his sword back from my neck just a few inches. "Oh, you understand our purpose?" "No," I replied as I lifted my head. "I understand your weakness." And summoning all my strength, I leaped straight up, knocking his sword from him with one hand as I brought my kukuri in a slash up the length of his torso with the other. It severed the chain around his neck, and the symbol fell along with his body, shattering in a flash of light and crystal as it hit the ground. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Elsbin hit the floor with a thud. In a second, I was at his throat with the kukuri, but I could see it was unnecessary. He had been dealt his death wound, and blood oozed from beneath his rent robes. "I'm sorry, Balos," I said as I knelt by him, "but the return of the Crimson Demon is too great a threat to all of us." Balos gave a hacking laugh, a few drops of blood coloring his white beard. "Fool," he croaked at last, "you're a fool. I wasn't the Crimson Demon. Now you've ensured you're a..." Then his head fell back to the floor, eyes rolled back to the ceiling, and he lay motionless. I sheathed my kukuri. "Are you all right, Elsbin?" I asked, my eyes studying Balos' face. "Yes," came the reply. "Now I am indeed fine." But the voice wasn't Elsbin's. It was deep and guttural, and as I turned I saw a blinding flash and heard what sounded like a low laugh. When my vision cleared, I saw that the Crimson Pact agent was gone. On the ground beneath where her body had been was a fine powder, which, as I walked over to investigate, began to shift and blow away as the breeze caused by my movement reached it. Kneeling, I scooped a small sample of the powder into my glove and held it up to the light. It was barely visible, the grains falling from my hand even as I looked, but the color was obvious. It was a dark crimson. Next to the powder lay the moon pendant, its rubies glowing a deep, deep red. And as I rose and turned to go, my cloak swirling around me, I remembered a rhyme Chaosthenes had taught me years ago when I had first become an apprentice, something so silly it seemed little more than a child's poem. "Remember in calm, remember in storm, rituals and demons take many forms."
The Crimson Demon, read for you by the author, Gregory A. Wilson.
What you would say if I could listen, I might be less afraid to play. I've seen inside you, I've known your mind, I've traced your instincts, I've watched your innocence unwind. sun wind, yeah. Yeah.
Kindness from The Road. Whoops. Oh, and it actually segues online.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah. That was and is Gregory Wilson, Gregory A. Wilson, by byline, as it were. And you were playing and doing exactly what on that cut?
I was on the lead vocalist.
I figured.
There's also some trumpet, which you can't hear very well there in the background, but I play trumpet in the band as well, and so there's a lot of that sort of interspersed.
Not at the same time.
On the song. No. Except in recordings. In recordings is a lot easier. No,
yes.
But no, I am not. I'm not the Peter Frampton of trumpet players, I'm afraid.
Yes.
Thank God for that. Yeah, thank God for that.
Yes.
So that's what I do in the band, and actually that particular song, One Small Kindness, was written as a reaction to my first reading of Lolita, I didn't react well to it, and I've never reacted well to that book, and a lot of it is sort of intentionally creepy, which is the way I felt about the entire book.
Well, yeah, but I think Nabokov would have...
He would have approved, you think?
I think so. Well, I'll ask Simon when he comes in.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I think that's basically what he was aiming for.
Fair
enough.
Don't you? Yes, probably. Oh, yeah. I mean, I certainly wasn't bored. And as long as one wasn't bored, I think he would have been pleased.
You finished the book.
Yeah, of course.
Went all the way through it.
Of course.
You know, and you felt creepy.
Yes.
And yeah, I think that, you know, he's a creepy character.
Right, exactly. I was going to say, what would Humbert have said?
But yeah, exactly.
So I thought there was a little bit of a literary connection there.
What did you think of the movie?
I've heard actually an audio version with Jeremy Irons. I haven't seen the movie. And
I mean the first film.
Right, the first one.
The Kubrick.
Yeah, and I have not seen it, so I can't say. I have only read the book several times, and I haven't seen the movie.
Okay,
you should.
Really? I mean, because Kubrick really brings forth the comedy. I mean...
Interesting.
It's not... James Mason is incredible.
Okay.
Shelley Winters... method acting at its finest.
Yep.
And Peter Sellers, you know, what are you going to say? This is Peter Sellers showing that he could act.
Yeah.
And you're watching this oh so serious film. If a film could have a tongue in its cheek as you are watching it,
this would be it, huh?
It is Lolita.
Interesting.
Definitely.
Okay. All right. Well, I will have to check it out.
I'm a big Kubrick fan.
Okay. Yeah. I'll have to check it out if I want to be creeped out again. My goodness.
It will do that. Of course, Kubrick is never. He's faithful to the book, but in his own way, which is always the way with Kubrick.
Right. Mm-hmm.
His Shining is not Stephen King's Shining, although his Spartacus is probably...
He's pretty close.
It's Dalton Trumbo's Spartacus versus the Howard Fast novel.
Probably not as much room to move with that, I would think.
Especially because he took it over from a different director, from Anthony Mann. And by the way, speaking of Spartacus, we have to note the passing of the lead actress of Spartacus, Jean Simmons.
Jean Simmons, yep.
Who was quite the doll, as in Guys and Dolls, which is how I guess most of us will remember her. But yeah. She had quite a career. She was amazing.
Yeah, and a lot of those movies, stories and movies that are being returned, I noticed we had talked about the fact that I had seen Avatar a couple days ago, and on the way out of the theater, I noticed that they're remaking Clash of the Titans, and I thought, Lord, you know, and then also remaking a Karate Kid, which again, I'm not really clear why that needs to be remade either, but in any case,
I'm not sure why it was made.
Yeah, but... right, fair enough. But yeah, I mean, remaking Clash of the Titans. I mean,
that's a pretty bizarre concept. And they're bringing in a cast, but you know, who's going to play Olivier?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, I guess we'll get better. I guess we'll get real technology for change instead of the stop motion stuff. But
there is such a fabulous charm to the Harryhausen. And I mean, that's what it's all about.
I agree. Yep.
I mean, nobody's watching that movie to see the acting talents of Harry Hamlin and Ursula Andress.
No.
We're there for that owl.
Yeah, exactly, for the owl. And, oh, my gosh, the technique that was used in Sinbad, too. Same technique used in Sinbad as well.
Absolutely. So it's a terrible movie that I love to watch over and over again.
There you go. Now they're going to make it into a terrible into movie a you might not want to watch at all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's probably going to be a remake as opposed to a reboot.
I would think. Although reboots have really been popular lately. That's the way
and
to go.
Some of them have been good.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
I was not expecting Star Trek to be any good.
I love that. I thought Star Trek was really excellent.
I was really impressed. And I'm not a J.J. Abrams fan.
Yeah.
I'm ready to diss him at the drop of a tricorder. But I had to say I thought that was a fabulous movie.
I really liked it.
Every time I mention Star Trek, and I still haven't seen Avatar, though I will, even though I've been advocating it for so long, well before most people heard of it, I still have to tell people one of the best science fiction films of last year. Oh, I believe it's just out on DVD or about to come out on DVD.
Is?
Nobody has seen it. It's called Cold Souls.
No, I hadn't even heard of it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, exactly. Nobody has. It played in New York at the Landmark Cinema.
Okay.
For a couple of months, it stars Paul Giamatti playing.
That's a good start.
he plays Paul Giamatti.
Okay, all right.
it's one of the. It's very meta.
Okay.
And I have to look it up, if only to tell people the name of the director. And I ought to try to get her on the air or something because she's local.
Mm-hmm.
The movie's very local.
Cold Souls.
Brooklyn. Yeah, Brooklyn and Moscow.
Okay.
Basically.
Okay.
Very briefly, Paul Giamatti plays this actor named Paul Giamatti, who's starring in Uncle Vanya and just cannot get it right.
Okay.
And he's really, putting too much into it. He's got problems. So his agent says, there's an article in The New Yorker about how you can put your soul into storage. And so he does. He goes and he finds a place on Roosevelt Island where my favorite line of the movie is, if you like, you don't have to store your soul here. If you want to avoid sales tax, we can store it in Jersey City. And Giamatti says, no, I don't want my soul in Jersey City. And he ends up finding that his soul has been taken by a mule, somebody who takes souls into herself and transports them to Russia.
Wow.
Where his soul was sold. Somebody wanted this bad soap actress wanted a great actor and thought that she was getting Al Pacino. But instead, she ends up with the soul of Paul Giamatti.
Wow.
Well, Giamatti gets the soul of what he thought would be a Russian poet so that he could do Vanya, but instead gets a factory worker.
Oh, wow.
And from there, it gets crazy.
It sounds like, being John Malkovich meets a Russian fairy tale is what it sounds like to me.
And it definitely owes something to being John Malkovich, which I still think is one of the wonderful movies. Sophie Barthes, B-A-R-T-H-E-S, wrote and directed this film.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure it's out on DVD.
Okay.
Or just about to come out. And I am pushing this officially for a Nebula Award.
Okay.
Don't know. It could never win a Hugo. Couldn't come near a Hugo because that's a popularity award. But the Nebula Award is about writing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I know it won't win. It's not the point. It needs the recognition. This is great science fiction.
I'm going to have to check it out.
Or
I had not heard of it.
Depending on nobody has.
Yeah, I had not heard of it. Wow.
Nobody has heard of this film. It's a wonderful little movie.
Wow.
I don't know anybody who has seen it who didn't like it. Now, best film of the year? I don't know. Sleeper of the year. Let's
Hey, if it's Paul Giamatti, you can start and stop there. That's good enough for me.
It may be like the quintessential Paul Giamatti movie in many ways.
That's neat. I'll have to check it out.
John Adams aside.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't count. He's great in that, but
Right. That's a little...
It's different.
Different, yeah.
That's him acting as opposed to being a Paul Giamatti movie.
Right.
This is... I know it's a Sophie Barthes movie, but it's a Paul Giamatti movie.
Cold Souls. I'll check that out.
Cold Souls, yeah. Now I'm taking up all this time talking about other things.
No.
Well, it's up to you. We can chat, or you have a short piece that you wanted to read.
Well, I do. I thought I wanted to throw this out there because it's the prologue to my second novel and is written in a very different style than what you just heard. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you wanted to do that and take a few calls or something like that, or this is about 8 minutes, I think.
Okay, well, we're already getting calls, so we can go either way. We can take calls, or you can read, and then we can take calls.
I don't know. I guess read and take calls, and then people can comment on both. Does that make sense?
Go right ahead.
All right. So as I say, this is much shorter. this is the prologue to my second novel, which is currently being shopped by my agent. And the novel is called Icarus. It is the opening to a second series. It is this particular one, as you will hear, is told from the voice of a particular character whose name is Jelinek, and that gets explained as you read the novel. On the day that Icky fell into the volcano, making one hell of a racket when he landed, I didn't know then that he always made entrances like that. That was the first I laid eyes on the kid. I was out digging for flame petals with Rig. Like usual, Rig was bellyaching about having to do work, and like usual, I was telling him to shove it. "How are we going to make it if we don't have something to sell?" I says, and he gives me those big eyes of his and droops his ears down like always when I yell at him. "No, I'm not going to hear it, you," I says. "You don't do all that much work, you know. What if I treated you like other people treat their solars, hmm?" And he pretends not to hear me, you know, snuffing around and scratching his ear, waving those two tails like he's got an itch he can't scratch. "I could, you know," I says. "I could keep you caged up for as long as I want and no one to give a hoot. There's lots that think solars ought to be treated like pests, you know, like flickerbrads or something." And of course he looks up at me and starts howling, you know, so sensitive, that friggin' thing, which is pretty funny for something that stands about tall as I do. Okay, that ain't very tall, but still. "Yeah, never mind that," I says. "I'll just think about it, you know. Maybe a nice cage, some magister ice around it or something." And then Rig just loses it, you know, just starts a-crying and howling and carrying on, and I starts thinking about him waking some flame demon or something, and then wouldn't we be set? All right," I says finally. "Quit the funeral, I won't cage you. But you gotta do your work, or I won't be able to afford to buy a cage, or even keep the house. You gotta do the work." And he jumps up and starts running around, you know, trying to jump on me, practically knocking me into the lava flow. Yeah, enough," I says, "let's just get to it." And off he goes, like a flickerbrad flying away from a cool, bounding ahead of me and sniffing like he's got something stuck up his nose. Rig's a pain sometimes, but I gotta say there ain't no better solar west of the hole, not when it comes to finding flame petals. They grow below the ground where the flow still moves a bit, and it's way too hot for most of us grounders to look. For a solar, well, you could throw them in fresh lava and they'd barely feel it. But a lot of them can't really smell worth a damn, and a lot of the rest are too wild to use. That's why folks tend to stay away from them. One side of those tails flying, red fur bristling, of course those teeth and those crazy sideways eyes, and both just head the other way. Can't say as I blame him, really. Rig is wild, too, I guess, but only because he don't want to listen sometimes. Oh, but he's not dangerous, at least ways not to me. He's a big baby, to tell you the truth. But he could smell all right. I've seen him sniff out a Pelar from half a mile away when most Solars would have been running in circles, even though he tried to eat it when he found it, like usual. I told him 100 times, don't eat those things. They don't show their spikes till after they're swallowed, but he won't listen, and then I have to hear him howling for 3 Santa cycles till he finishes digesting. Not the biggest brains in the Vol, for sure, but still, he can find those flame petals when he's got a mind to. On his best solar cycle, I've seen him find 10, and that'll go a ways down here. But for a couple of weeks, we've been coming up pretty light. 2, 3, maybe 4 on a good solar cycle. And I was starting to get worried. I got bills to pay, you know? Rig took us over the West Plains a good way, sniffing and scratching the ground, and a couple times I thought we had something. He would stop, smell, dig a bit. But each time he only got down a bit into the dirt and then was off again after the next scent. No worries. Even in the best digs, you get a couple of false starts. But nearly a full Santa cycle went by and nothing, not even a broken flame petal, something I could maybe have tried to plant and get something out of. Finally, Rig sat down panting, and I didn't blame him. I was tired as a magman myself, and I couldn't have gone much further. So I plopped myself down on a rock and waited, taking a swig from the canteen now and again as I looked about while Rig rolled around and basically made a fool of himself. We'd come a lot farther than even I thought before, almost near in the central plains, and this wasn't territory I knew too well, except to be careful of it. You hear stories, you know, tales of folks vanishing without a trace, crazy tales for crazy people, I always say, but still, you don't live long down here without knowing how to keep your eyes open and your ears near the ground as much as you can. Mountains rose up to the north, up where some say the Firbargs live, if you still think they're alive like some fool people do, but no offense meant if you're one of them. And to the south, the lava pools of the Salamander Kings. Over to the east, I could make out the stretch of jagged rock that covers the central plains. And far in the distance, farther than I could see, the east plains were there, farther than I've ever been, too. And beyond them was the hole, leastways if I remember what my dad told me when I was just old enough to be foolish. "Don't go that far, son," he used to say. "Don't go any farther than you need to go to get by. Stay in the places you know and you'll never be caught napping." And I never did. Leastways, not until I met Icky. Nope, I stayed in the West, where folks are, well, they ain't decent exactly, but at least you know the kind of damn fools they are anyways. Of course, if it had been up to my dad, I wouldn't have been doing what I was doing to begin with. He was a prospector and taught me most everything I knew, but he hated every cycle of it. What he really loved doing was crafting. He cranked out gadgets and gizmos like they was going out of style, which it turns out they already had by the time he made them, but nothing got my pop down. Made some fire crystal goggles no one wanted, melted them down and turned them into windows to keep the heat down inside. No one wanted those either. Broke them into bits, rounded off the sharp spots, and used them to cover flame petal shoots. I used to think nothing bad would ever happen to my dad. He was pretty tall for a grounder, nearly 5 feet, and I mostly remember looking up at him when he was talking to me. I wanted to be just like him, even though he told me not to, that there wasn't anything about prospecting that was worth it. I said I understood, but he knew why I was lying, and he never made me promise anything different. And then he was gone, and what was I supposed to do but try to live like him? Except the crafting, which I ain't too good at, actually. Now, folks told me I looked kind of like my dad, except shorter. Same red skin, same red hair and eyes, but truth be told, I'm nothing like him. People liked him. The best I can do is keep my head down and keep out of the way. Maybe I was too tired, or maybe I was too busy living in some damn fool memory, but either way, I must not have been paying attention for a while, because all of a sudden Rig sets to growling and yelping and nearly scares me into falling off my rock. It might have been better to fall anyway, because when I looks up, what should I see but the last thing I would have expected? 7 feet tall, red horns and tail, spiky fur, teeth that don't fit proper inside the mouth. Yep, a sure enough flame demon, and there he was right in front of us, gnashing his teeth and eyes so wide they could have dropped outside of his head. Maybe he was trying to decide which one of us to eat first, or maybe he was just having fun, but anyways, he didn't move at first. Just looked at us with that crooked smile of his. Frankly, I just about gave it up there and spent most of my last cycles alive cursing myself for being so stupid. I mean, first of all, you almost never see flame demons this far west, but like I said, I didn't know this territory too well, and things had been kind of strange lately. And if we hadn't been so desperate for a couple of lousy flame petals, we wouldn't have been out so far from home anyways. And I should have been paying closer attention. But now we were in it for sure, and I just felt bad for Rig, mostly. I mean, me, I'm just a washed-up prospector, you know, but he don't know any better, and if it wasn't for me, maybe he'd be running around free somewhere instead of getting eaten alive. And wouldn't you know it, the damn fool Solar stepped in front of me growling, as if it could do anything against a flame demon. I mean, Solars aren't small, you know. I mean, they can defend themselves, but against a flame demon, well, really. "Come on now," I says in a low voice, holding my search stick like a fool while the demon steps forward. "Come on, you don't want none of Rig here. You let him go and deal with me. I got what you want, anyways." And I held up my stick and got ready to do some damn foolish thing like yell and charge or something like that. But just then I thought I heard a sound above us, kind of whistling, and I took a step back. The demon raised his claw and got ready to swipe, but he never did. All of a sudden something hit him head-on from above, some flurry of white and feathers, and down he goes in a heap while Rig and I jumps back. First I couldn't tell what happened, but then I saw the demon get to his feet, shaking his head and screaming bloody murder, and I saw the other thing get up as well. Even now I can't explain what it was like to see it stand. Tall, thin, two arms, two legs, curly brown hair, white skin, and young. But this expression on its face, kind of serene, like it knew what was going to happen, that's what amazed me the most. That and the things on its back, of course. Because that demon comes up swinging and screaming, you know, and in it comes, and the other one just smiles, and all of a sudden I saw it unfold these wings, by Saul. Wings, I tell you, white feathered wings, almost as wide as the body was tall, and out it stretches them. The demon hesitated, then roared again and came in, and the other thing, Well, it just lifted its arms, you know, and all of a sudden those wings glowed blue and blue light shot out all over the place, and I fell backwards near blinded. I heard this screech, and then a wail, and then a sigh, and then nothing at all. And when I looked up and I could see, there it all was, Rig on the ground whimpering like a baby, some pile of ash that I think used to be a flame demon, and that other creature lying on the ground with his eyes closed, those huge wings folded beneath him. Entrances, I tell you. That kid knew how to make an entrance.
Nice. Nice. And that's from Icarus.
That is from Icarus.
All righty. So,
as I said, very different.
Yeah, very much so. So if you, the listeners, would like to call up and speak with Greg Wilson, Gregory A. Wilson would be the name on the book cover, but
Greg's
on the radio, Greg will do.
Yeah.
The telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900, and calls are certainly coming in, so we'll say good morning. Good morning, you're on the air.
We want the hot beef injection.
The witch injection? No, he wouldn't stay on long enough for me to find out what the crank call was about. He'll call back, though. He always does. Mm-hmm. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. Just checking. What was the name of the first story you read before, The Crimson Demon?
The name was called The Crimson Demon, I think. That's still kind of in process, that title, but yeah.
It was great, actually, and the other one from Icarus, it was cool. I just figured, because I haven't listened to the show in a couple of weeks, I figured I'd get your guys' opinion on the new season of Doctor Who. What'd you think?
The one that ended.
Yeah, I mean, no, the trailer for the new season is out online. I don't know if you've seen it or not. It's got Matt Smith in it. So.
Yeah, well, I saw the trailer that the BBC had. And, yeah. You know, what can you say about a trailer?
True.
I mean, from what I have seen of Matt Smith, I have to say I am very... skeptical, but Stephen Moffat taking over. I mean, the best episodes of the 21st century Doctor Who were all written by Stephen Moffat.
Really?
What iteration of Who? I mean, what Who level are we up to at this point? I mean,
the 11.
Okay, 11, wow, yeah. Boy. That is one heck of a... See, I, you know, the Doctor Who thing for me was never... something about it always felt... I couldn't deal with the phone booth and the whole thing. I just never really could get into it. And then I had a friend just literally yesterday tell me, have you seen the new Doctor Who? You've got to see it immediately. So I'm going to have to check it out, obviously.
We finished 5 years.
You know, I know, you know, but it was just, you know, my thing was always Star Trek, and that was what I focused my attention on. And, you know, maybe a little Space 1999 on the side. But,
you see, if you're going to talk quality...
But not Doctor Who.
Doctor Who trumps...
Oh, I agree. I don't deny it. I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
Molto bene.
Two things about that. Tempest Bradford was on the air last week with Altered Fluid and everything, and she mentioned a forthcoming anthology, Chicks Who Dig Time Lords.
Oh.
So mean, you know that I couldn't leave that alone, so we're going to be doing stuff with that on the air in March.
Oh, that's great.
Okay, I'm going to be sure to tune in then.
And number two, something that I've picked up on. There's going to be, get this, an American version of Torchwood?
Really?
I also heard they're going to do, Sci-Fi Channel's doing a remake of Being Human.
Yes, I heard that. And I'm watching series 2 of Being Human right now.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, awesome.
Yes.
Let me know how that goes, because I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't want to give much away other than the second series is a little bit darker.
Same cast?
Oh, yes, absolutely same cast. Good. Although the pilot was a different cast.
Yeah.
Except for Russell Tovey, of course.
Yeah.
I still say Russell Tovey should have been the 11th Doctor.
I wouldn't have minded. He was great as George, I think. What was his name? As the werewolf?
I'm trying
to remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, totally homage to American Werewolf in London.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Oh, God.
And we'll see about the forthcoming werewolf.
Wow. Oh, yeah, Nina. Yeah, that was... I'm sci-fi geeking right now. I'm sorry. I haven't had my fix in a while, so...
Okay. But, yeah, we'll be talking Who in the future. And, yeah, I mean, I could go on and on about the finale. Here. I'll say this. The finale certainly had one line too many.
Really?
And that was the last line. I thought it was gratuitous. Oh,
yeah. I don't want to go?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was unnecessary. Yeah. And no, it's not like death. Watch all the other regenerations.
Yep. So I hear they're actually slating him to come back in a couple episodes. I don't know how, but...
Well, of course. You know, I mean, if they do it properly, they'll have Matt Smith, Chris Eccleston, and David Tennant all in one.
That would be amazing.
And be, you know, a second version of the Three Doctors.
Oh, wow. That'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, it's an obvious one.
I just saw the first one online like 2 weeks ago, so... All right, good.
I'm going back to the William Hartnell days to fill in the time until March when Matt Smith...
I'll be sure to tune in and call up. All right?
Okay, great.
Thanks. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Alrighty. Good morning. You're on the radio. Oh, nope. You're a dial tone, so you're not on the radio. I won't keep you on. Anyway, hi there. You're on the air. It's these migrating lights.
These migrating lights.
They're very strange. Hi there. You're on the air.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
Good morning, Gregory.
Good morning, Robert. Okay, how are you?
Another CUNY person.
Yes, CUNY. You're going to do a CUNY show, James?
I think so, yes. I was thinking of you in that.
Oh, good, good. Gregory, I have a few questions, and I'll run them quick.
Okay.
I was expecting an Arlek to walk through the inn door.
No.
Is this the same universe?
Yeah, no, not the same universe. But it's each story that I read, the short story and then that other thing, are both from two different universes.
Okay,
so.
Now, what I love is your, and I'm going to use this word, oxymoronic nomenclature. Honest thief. You know, I expect all your religious establishments to be on atheist way. You get what I mean?
Yes, I do. And,
yeah, but, you know, honest thief is a time-honored fantasy tradition.
Oh, no, I know.
Bilbo was the thief.
I know that. Well, yeah, I know that. I mean, it's even used in Irish traditional tales. Anyway, but I do want to ask a question about the Argots. I know this is going to be a stretch, but you didn't base that order in any way on the Jedi, did you? And I don't know why I'm thinking, but when I hear justice, balance, principles, I'm saying,
No.
Okay.
No, because you know, it's a group of, you know, religious assassins that you know, their assessment on what is just and what is not is...
Oh, the Argoths are religious assassins.
Yeah, and it's not the Argoth. It's actually, Argoth is the god. So it's really the order of
Argoth
is the idea. Yeah.
Now, question. You know, I figured you were going to pull an O'Henry. I didn't think it was going to be that simple. I said, I know where Gregory's going with this. I really know. And it's a great story. But, I loved it. And maybe when you read enough of this stuff, you sort of figure endings. But it's very clever. Is this going to be continued? It's got to be.
Well, you know, in fact, this the reason I did this story was because I mentioned this anthology that I was contributing to, and I'm in the midst of working on my third novel, which is about the character Greyshade. In fact, it's called Greyshade.
You told me that in Riverdale.
Yep, that's right. And so that is basically what this is about. But the Crimson Demon thing doesn't really come into play in that book. It's just that Greyshade is obviously front and center.
So
and you get a lot more detail about that whole world.
So you're going to do a novel on Greyshade?
In fact, probably more than one. Yeah, definitely.
Last question. Are you doing any future readings up in Riverdale that I should know about?
You know, you'll be the first to know when I do. I imagine that I will, and I'm looking forward to doing more stuff.
I would love to come back and see you.
Yeah, that would be great. Robert came to see me for a reading, and I would love to do that, sure.
Thanks a lot, guys. Bye.
Thanks.
Have a good morning. Bye-bye. And, let's try to sneak a couple more calls in. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello. Turn on your radio, please.
We want the hot thief injection.
Ah, there we go. Thank you. I knew he would call back and elaborate. Hi there. You're on the air. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Ro.
Good morning, Monroe.
I found the reading very well done. And even changing voice quality. And I thought the bouncer might be William Shakespeare for some reason. You know, you remember at the very beginning there was the allusion to a bouncer?
Yes, although he's actually the innkeeper in this case. But Shakespeare could have been an innkeeper too.
the innkeeper was Shakespeare?
Well, no. Could have been in that scenario. I hadn't thought of him as being Shakespeare, but I could see it.
Well, anyway. Then I would have liked a little bawdy singing or so between the action.
Yeah, that would work, actually.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I should think more about that.
But I'm reminded of last week's story, James, because I just couldn't get with it about a stegosaurus in with these people, and everybody liked the story. I didn't care for the story and the appreciation that it got. I don't know why, but... I wanted to say that on that program, but
yeah, you should have.
I wish I had, but you can't win them all. But the thing is, I'm just amazed that St. John's has a teacher who's writing this kind. Do you teach English there? Or
I do. I teach literature. Yeah, I do.
creative writing?
Creative writing and also fantasy fiction, among other courses, but those are two of my big ones, yeah.
All I can say is I wonder about the religious overtone of the university.
Well, I keep it very non-sectarian, let's put it that way.
Okay, well, anyway, I mean, I always wonder about institutions of higher learning and any learning, you know.
Yeah.
It has to be handled very benevolently. I'm also sorry about the Haitian whole thing. And I wonder if anybody's thought of the fact whether they should try to rebuild Port-au-Prince, because if it's so earthquakey, what about the foundations even in that situation?
But, I've wondered, not to be glib, but about California.
Yeah,
all those things. Yeah. I mean, Gary Noel is against the rebuilding New Orleans.
Yeah, well, for the same reasons, yeah.
And I get it, but it's off topic for us, and we're out of time.
Okay, goodbye.
Have a good morning. Okay. Oh, and Monroe, happy 50th. Whoop, okay. Monroe is like, you know, one of the longest time.
Yeah.
Good and often off topic callers, but he was very on topic this morning, wasn't he?
Yes.
So, for all things Greg Wilson, people should go to
GregoryAWilson.com, which I will again ensure that it is up. My webmaster is aware of the situation, or will be soon.
But what you can do in the meantime, if you can't wait to check it out, is you can Google it.
Yeah.
And then click on cached.
Right, and you can do that too, and you
can
access it that
right
way.
Now.
That's right.
I need to announce very quickly, February 2nd, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will have its final reading at the South Street Seaport Museum before we move to the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. Our curator will be Cherie Renee Thomas. Our readers will be Amma Patterson and Daniel Jose Old. So... I'll tell more about that next week.
And this is still in the anniversary season, right?
This You're finishing up,
yeah.
Right in the
middle
of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me again, Jim. I enjoyed it as always.
Whoops. 2 hours is too short a period of time. Oh, that was your website still playing. I'll have to go away from that to get to the outro music.
Okay.
So everybody stay tuned for As I Please, and Greg will be back at some point in the future.
Well, I'd like that.
And in the meantime, take care. Have a good week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Oh, yes, and occasionally visit ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF.
Silver, and I steer towards the sun. Saturday, 7, as I please. What more do you need to know? You need to know that you are tuned to WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial here in New York City, and we are broadcasting from the butt end of Wall Street overlooking the East River, just a stone's throw away from the South Street Seaport. And I guess I should also say, good morning, hello, welcome. And that, I think, covers that. Oh, Ken, can you come here for a moment, please? Thank you. You can always count on things to crap out on you here at WBAI. Well, apparently, there is no operator on duty. So we'll do the best we can with the crap that we've got. All I can say is, you think I'm going to play your cart now? You can forget it. And you are tuned to WBAI New York City, where nothing works for long. That is for sure. And I guess we'll just have to struggle along with the crapola that is WBAI. You know, dear comrades, it is proverbial, if indeed it is not axiomatic. Love to say that word, axiomatic. You don't have an opportunity, you don't have nearly enough opportunities in this world of ours to say that something is axiomatic. However, getting back to the start, it is proverbial, if not axiomatic, that a chicken is nothing but a bird, and yet, oh yes, and yet. In the former Soviet Union, people are rising up in protest about the bland, undistinguished, tasteless chicken that is being served to them. Tasteless, undistinguished, hardly even recognizable chicken from the U.S. of A. And One might say that this is just an example of some of the hardships that the Soviet Union faced upon its collapse, because there was emergency measures taken, and part of those emergency measures were from Boy George Bush himself, who sent over literally tons of chicken to feed the hungry people of what we now refer to as the former Soviet Union. However, in the course of time, the chicken market of the Soviet Union has expanded for the United States, but the people are unhappy. It is now worth something like $800 million a year, which is something like 600,000 tons. And if you were to think of a chicken as averaging, let us say, 5 or 6 pounds, 600,000 tons of chicken, that's a lot of chicken. However, don't you worry about a thing, because we're not sending chickens as such to the former Soviet Union. We're sending the necks, the backs, the butts, the feet, you know, all that stuff that's left over from ours. And now the people say, "But this is terrible. It got no flavor. It's got nothing to it. Why, we look at this and we're not even sure if it was ever alive," as opposed to this chicken, which we grew ourselves. And it is, I think, important that we, the people, stand up and protest inferior quality wherever it may be found. And you don't have to look far to find it. Alas, alack-a-day. Now, the former Soviet Union has passed a variety of laws in order to ensure that the chicken or the food that is served on the peasant's table is as of good a quality as one can hope for in a world such as ours. And these rules, these legislation, you know, banning chemicals and various other things, all of which seems to make a certain amount of sense, and, might I add, are not so far removed from the standards established by the European community. However, apparently the United States says, "Well, that's all very well and good for you, but not for us. Our chicken is our chicken, and you will take it, and you will like it." And the former Soviet Union is saying, "We think not, my friends, we think not." To virus. And indeed, by the way, the American chicken is often referred to in the Soviet Union as bush legs, although we hasten to point out once again, few legs or drumsticks to be found there, but a lot of backs, a lot of necks, a lot of feet. This final comment from this item, which I clipped just the other day from the New York Times, a statement which, though comes from a former communist, I dare say, should appeal to all and sundry. Because you got to bear in mind, the United States is sending this chicken, is preparing this chicken for export. They are sending this chicken, we are sending this chicken to places where people need it and where people can pay for it. However, as this citizen remarks, a problem has arisen with the United States, which is continuing to insist that we show them that their chicken is harmful. "Excuse me," says this Russian citizen. "We pay the money, so we will set the conditions for what kind of meat we want and what kind we don't." And you know, that is a very good principle to have and to live by. It is, after all, the duty of the seller to accommodate himself or herself to the demands of the consumer. After all, the consumer is always right, and if the consumer doesn't like it, you can't force it down the throat. That, at least, is the principle which I would like to live by.
barbecue chicken. Won't you send it down the line?
Say, everyone's talking about chicken. Chicken's a popular word. But anywhere you go, you're bound to find a chicken ain't nothing but a bird. Some people call it a fowl. That's the story I heard. But let them call it this and let them call it that. A chicken ain't nothing but a bird. You can boil it, roast it, broil it, cook it in a pan or a pie. Eat it with potatoes, rice or tomatoes. A chicken's still what you got. Boy, it was a dish for old Caesar.